This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. One of the most surprising stories happened on a key New Hampshire highway this week. On Wednesday, a large sinkhole developed on Interstate 93 in Concord. Here's Department of Transportation spokesman Bill Boynton.
The hole is about 20 feet deep, 12 feet long, and 14 feet wide, so a major hole there in the road that has shut down northbound traffic.
Meanwhile, Eversource Energy unveiled a new plan for its Northern Pass project. One major change, burial of 52 more miles of power lines. Opponents like Jack Savage of the Forest Society said that's good, but not good enough.
We think this is a step in the right direction. Perhaps need to take a few steps more in order to get it right.
The Granite State saw Republican presidential candidates aplenty this week. At an event in Derry, Donald Trump talked about what's become his central issue, immigration.
I want it to be so beautiful, because maybe someday they're going to call it the Trump Wall, maybe. So I have to make sure it's beautiful, right? I'll be very proud of that wall. If they call it the Trump Wall, it has to be beautiful.
And national media descended upon Concord for the trial of a St. Paul School graduate charged with raping a freshman girl last year. At the heart of the story, a ritual called the Senior Salute, where graduating males aim to have sexual encounters with younger female students. Here's defense lawyer J.W. Carney.
The girls would be honored and proud about this, that they were the focus of a senior salute, that a senior had thought that this girl was pretty enough or interesting enough to be the subject of a senior salute.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests for the Roundup this week are Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Sunday News. And Gary, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much.
And also with us, Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. And Jeff, thank you for being here.
Great to be here.
And also with us, Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for us here at NHPR. And Josh, thank you for taking time out.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, I want to start all of you with something that just broke yesterday, and that's that the city of Dover filed suit against the state of New Hampshire over education funding. Gary Reno, sounds familiar. What's this all about?
It's like Yogi Berra used to say, deja vu all over
right.
again.
Right.
You know, you didn't have to be an oracle to see this one coming, because when the Supreme Court ruled on the education funding, they basically said that the state has an obligation to pay for an adequate education for every child in the state. And what happened about 5 years ago was there was a huge change in the formula and the way that this money got distributed. And in order to do that, they did what they call these stabilization grants, which basically held everybody harmless.
That's why it's been quiet, for a while.
But what they also did was they capped the amount of money that school districts could get year to year. And consequently, fast-growing communities like Dover, Salem, Windham, and places like Bedford, who put in new high schools, where you have a great number of students moving in or a great number of growth, a lot of growth, were getting less money than they actually were owed. And so this one has been coming. And everybody figured it was probably Windham that was going to do it, but finally Dover got – we're facing the September 1st payment from the state to these communities, and these communities are seeking to get their full amount of money and not have it subject to this cap.
Well, it's interesting because we keep hearing about, you know, New Hampshire's demographics and people having fewer kids and the state aging. But Jeff Feingold, there are communities where there's a rising number of students,
yes,
and they're saying, hey, these caps are constraining us.
Exactly. There are. And there are also a lot of communities where there are declining enrollments and they are pretty much desperate to keep that funding because that, you know, it, as we know, the state has been providing more funding through the statewide property tax, but it's still not anywhere near the level that a lot of the school districts really would want or think they require.
How does this fit into the whole state budget stalemate, Josh Rogers? Is this part of it or not?
It certainly as budget, you know, be a budget pressure should Dover prevail. I mean, we're talking about millions of dollars that would go to, I think there are about 40 districts that might stand to gain under this. I mean the majority of districts wouldn't because of the demographic factors you cited. I mean, one thing that's been interesting about this issue is that the degree to which plaintiffs or potential plaintiffs have chose to sort of pick their spots or to try to work it out politically at the state house rather than going to court. I mean, there was something, you know, inherently arbitrary about saying, you know, we're not going to follow what the court ruling said. We're just going to set this cap to try to, you know, kind of tamp down vast fluctuations in aid. And, you know, this is a case that's probably winnable. But the question is when you win, what are the political repercussions, and does this cause a, you know, another look at school funding? Does this pick up steam for a constitutional amendment? Does this create political headaches? And what does this mean down the road? So this is something that the districts have looked at and as they decide whether to sue or not.
Go ahead, Jeff.
As you said, I mean, really, it what's going to happen is it's not just Dover, and it's going to be other cities and towns will be joining in saying, hey, what about our piece of the pie?
Well, beneficiary.
Yeah, beneficiary. But, you know, the pressure is going to be much greater. And actually, if you look at the populations, a lot of these are larger cities. And if they have more representatives in the legislature than some of the smaller towns and cities, and you know, politically speaking, you know, what's going to happen in the legislature? They're going to have to be put up or shut up at one point.
Wow.
Well, the problem is there. I mean, when you get communities that are going to gain, they're also going to be communities that are going to lose, mm-hmm. and unfortunately,
spreadsheet wars.
Here we go again, and a lot of those communities are fairly large, like Manchester and Nashua, and these are communities that would lose money under this if you took away the cap and you sort of stabilized the whole thing.
So, Gary, there's been a lot of attention over this past budget cycle about budgeting by lawsuit. You know,
right.
You got the mental health lawsuit, you had the hospital lawsuit, so lawmakers and the governor had to consider those in crafting the budget. That put considerable constraints on them in crafting this budget. So how does this possible lawsuit play into that?
Well, this was part of the budget, too. It wouldn't have affected the 2016, but there were changes in 2017 to try to change some of this stuff. Well, there's a lawsuit for that. I mean, the longer this budget stalemate goes on, probably the longer we have a problem with the mental health systems. We might be seeing that again. If we don't reauthorize Medicaid expansion, we might see the hospitals back in again. And it could be really a lot of fun around here in the next couple of years.
Okay. Well, that's your definition of fun, Gary. That's great. Again, it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us as we cover some of the top news stories around the Granite State this week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. So, Josh Rogers, speaking of budgets, there was a conversation this week at the State House about the continuing budget stalemate. What happened, Josh?
Well, Republicans made an offer that they would potentially agree to a budget deal that would fund state employee pay raise that had been negotiated by the House administration. And this was, you know, one of many sticking points in the budget negotiations. And, you know, that overture didn't pan out as they hoped, or at least as how they said they hoped. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, political jockeying around this issue. But in any case, you know, stalemate continues.
Can you explain some of that political jockeying, Josh? Just help us figure out, like, why this is going on so long and when it might be resolved.
Well, I mean, Republicans have said they've said this from the beginning, they really want to wait till more numbers come in that gives them a better sense of where the state is. Certainly, Governor Hassan would have preferred this, you know, be resolved earlier. But, you know, sticking by their guns, obviously this has become potential electoral headache for everybody. But she's been attacked in advertising from national Republican groups over the budget. It's put on hold her decision about whether she might seek another term in the corner office, whether she would challenge Kelly Ayotte for U.S. Senate. And, you know, typically in these sorts of things, you know, the governor is more likely to kind of wear the political baggage on this than, you know, state senators and state reps that nobody's heard of. But, you know, Republicans don't want to be seen as utterly obstructionist also. I mean, the governor had earlier made a budget offer and, you know, tied up in this is some of the issues around substance abuse, which has been, you know, a big issue that the budget that passed and was vetoed increased funding for substance abuse. In the governor's counteroffer earlier this summer, she wanted to add more money on top of that, as well as increased spending in some other areas that Republicans didn't want. And, you know, issues around substance abuse have become a political hot button issue that it's really hard. It's tricky for politicians to attempt to negotiate.
Yeah, everybody says that they want to do more on that. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in the hour, too, with some federal money coming down the line. But Jeff Feingold, I did want to ask you very quickly about an item that caught a lot of people's interest, at least in central New Hampshire, and that's that sinkhole on Interstate 93. We heard earlier in the introduction to the show from Bill Boynton how big it was, certainly large enough for a car to fall into. We're all very lucky that nobody was killed. What caused this sinkhole?
Well, apparently what happened was there's a drainage pipe under that part of the highway that's owned by the city, and apparently it's well over 100 years old from what it sounds like, and it just gave way because of all the rains we've had and caused this sinkhole. And you know, it was – fortunately, like you said, there was no injuries. I guess one guy got arrested for reasons. I guess he was DWI or something, allegedly.
Yeah, he tried to go through all the barriers and so forth.
But, you know, in the end, it was repaired at least temporarily now, and it seems – everything seems to be fine. But I do have to say this. It does kind of raise questions.
Well, sure. Where's the next sinkhole?
Well, not only where the next sinkhole is, but we're talking about a drainage pipe that's over 100 years old, and this is part of the discussion we've been having for a couple of years now about infrastructure and, you know, the aging infrastructure of the state. And here's a perfect example of something that could happen. We're not just talking about the roads and bridges. We're talking about, you know, drainage pipes and water systems and things of that nature.
Right. Well, and of course, I drive through that area all the time because it's right around, right outside Concord. So it does make you wonder, Gary Reno, okay, is the next one half a mile down the road? Or where is it? It's kind of creepy.
Well, in most cases, you know, if you think about the interstate, it doesn't really go through urban areas. Most of it is in pretty rural areas. And in those areas, you have a very little opportunity for such a pipe being under the road. And in most cases, they dig down deep enough, so most of those drainage systems have been replaced or removed when they do it. But because this has been through Concord for where the A93 where it is and for such a long time. And I'm sure the same is probably true down in 293 in Manchester.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Gary. And we'll cross our fingers and hope that this doesn't happen again.
Don't look back, as one of the former DOT commissioners said.
Right. Well, coming up.
Right.
Coming up, local hearings on marijuana dispensaries go well in one instance, not so well in another. We'll hear from the Concord Monitor's Nick Reed on that story. Also, we'll update the new plan from the Northern Pass Project. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup here on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you as we cover some of the top stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the roundup this week are Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, and Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for NHPR. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. And Nick is joining us from York, Maine. Hi, Nick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to make a comment on the budget cuts on education. I'm calling from Maine, but whenever I hear anything about education, I want to chime in. But I've been a machinist for 36 years, and one of the mantras that were always driven into our head was safety, quality, schedule, cost. So we're trying to safely produce a quality education on time at the lowest cost. When you make arbitrary cuts or arbitrary caps to cost, then your other three goals will suffer. So cost really ends up being the result of the mission that you're trying to accomplish. And that's all I was wanting
to say. And I got your name wrong. I apologize. So it's Ed in York, Maine. So translate what you're saying, Ed, please, to our conversation about the New Hampshire budget.
Well, that when you make arbitrary cuts, you're going to affect the quality of your education. You work on the first three goals first: a safe place to be for an education, provide quality to every kid, and get it done on time. And the results of that are going to be the cost of what it takes to educate your kids. When you start making caps, you're just not going to be able to do the first three goals.
I see. Yeah, talking about the education lawsuit and the whole cap issue. Gary Reno, do you want to shed a little bit more light on that? It is confusing. I mean, thank you, Ed, for the call.
Part of the contention of the lawsuit, which is brought by Andy Valinsky for the city of Dover, Andy's been involved with the education funding lawsuits since time immemorial, it seems like. But part of their contention is that it's arbitrarily limits the amount of money that goes to certain towns and a school district. So it's not doing what the original ruling was, which is that every child should have a right to an adequate education. So they're saying their students in Dover are being denied that right because they're not getting the amount of money that they're supposed to be getting to provide an adequate education.
It's kind of like what the original Claremont lawsuit was about. Right. Basically, Claremont and the other plaintiffs' towns sued. Basically, say they weren't be able to provide an equitable education for this.
The contention is that it's driven by the money, not the education.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Ed, thank you for calling in. Again, you can join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, I want to turn now to the issue of medical marijuana dispensaries. As you all know, New Hampshire's system has yet to get up and running, but the process is moving ahead. With us now for more on that issue is Nick Reed. He's been covering the story for the Concord Monitor. Nick, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
So this law passed some time ago. Where are we now, Nick, in terms of establishing these four medical marijuana dispensaries?
Briefly, the law passed in 2013. In January, 14 applications were submitted. In May, three nonprofits were chosen by DHHS to operate four alternative treatment centers. And now they're on a tour around the state at some of the proposed sites where they're just kind of soliciting input from the public in those towns.
So proposed sites, Nick, so are these sites a done deal or the state is still looking at, you know, town A versus town B?
Well, there's still, take Plymouth, for instance, which I went to the hearing this week. They're still going through the planning process. Actually, last night they met with the planning board. So it's not so much that these people really felt that they couldn't drive the dispensary out of their town as much as some of them did want to do that. And the planning process, as they explained at the meeting, was really more about parking, lighting, really just the details of the site, less about, you know, whether the issue of whether they wanted the dispensary in their town.
So this is the Plymouth hearing, which I understand from your reporting, Nick, was kind of contentious. People aren't so sure they want this in the town. What were some of the issues that came up?
Yeah, well, certainly, with something like this, you're always going to get a spectrum of opinion, right? And then pretty much any opinion you could imagine was expressed. This meeting was packed. There were people spilling out in the hallway, and they stood there for 2.5 hours to listen to this discussion and ask questions. But one of the main concerns there was about drug diversion. Some people were noting the drug crisis in the state, and they're wondering whether having a dispensary in the town would send a message that it's okay to use marijuana. And a lot of them adamantly believed that this medical marijuana, even though it's, for a very narrow set of people who have specific conditions, they believed that it was going to end up, in the hands of the kids in the town.
So some concerns about drug diversion, concerns about security, Nick, right? And
definitely security as well. Yeah.
What about the cultivation centers, Nick, where the marijuana will be grown? Are these in the same places as the dispensaries or located somewhere else?
They can be in the same place, but as far as I know, they've been proposed for separate locations. In Plymouth, they said that they were going to try to keep the cultivation center's location under wraps, specifically for that security reason. But then, the following night in Peterborough, I also went to the hearing there, and that one was for a cultivation center. So in that case, we know where it is.
And in Peterborough, what did folks there say about the Cultivation Center? I think I read that it's right across from a high school.
It is. You know, it's not in sight of the high school. It's sort of recessed from the road. But and written into the state law is a border. You know, you can't be so close to a school zone. But this is basically right outside that border. So, you know, there was one senior at the high school who was a representative on the school board. And he was saying that, you know, he again didn't think it sent a good message to have it so close to the school. But in St. Peterborough, the sentiment was largely more favorable than in Plymouth. And I think it might have something to do with a little more comfort with the cultivation center side of things and the dispensary side of things.
So, Nick, what's next in this process for these towns, whether they are hosting a dispensary or a cultivation center? I mean, what I'm trying to get at is, do these towns have a say in whether these facilities will be sited there, or do they have a say in, you know, how they'll be lighted and what the parking will look like and what the security will look like?
Yeah, it seems like more of the latter. What was expressed at the Plymouth meeting was that, you know, the state mandated that these things be open in law. And, you know, if towns had specific zoning outlawing a pharmacy in a certain area, then in that way they could have determined where it was. But it's kind of too late for that in Plymouth, right? So there was discussion about, well, you know, we could get a warrant article to change our zoning, but they're expecting to open in January, and town meeting isn't until March. So I'm not sure they have much say. The next step is that the chosen applicants will be submitting for their registration certificate as of August 27th, I believe, where they'll sort of detail more specifics about the site and they're supposed to prove that they have local approval, though I'm not sure all of them are necessarily on track to have that.
Well, Nick, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Nick Reed, reporter with the Concord Monitor, updating us on some hearings on medical marijuana dispensaries and cultivation centers held in several communities this week. The number for you to join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Kevin joins us from Concord. Hi, Kevin. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. I'm interested in hearing whether your panelists think the stalemate in the state budget is an effort by the Republicans to hinder Governor Haslam's potential run for senator.
Okay. Josh Rogers, you talked about that before. Do you want to jump in on there, Jeff Feingold?
Yeah, I mean, I think on many levels it is. I mean, it's pretty apparent that, you know, they're trying to prevent her from declaring that she wants to run for senator, that they're really hamstringing her. But they do have some legitimate philosophical disagreements on the budget in terms of business tax cuts and things of that nature. So you can look at it both ways. But on one level, the politics of it, it's pretty apparent that this is part of it.
Okay, Kevin, thank you for the call. Again, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Gentlemen, I want to turn to another story, and this is not an easy one. Let me just preface it by saying that. Josh Rogers, NHPR, you and Paige Sutherland have been covering the rape trial concerning a St. Paul School graduate. National media, The New York Times, The Washington Post, they've all come to Concord to cover this. Why is this a national story, Josh?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. You know, it's a glimpse of sort of crime and sex on a campus. Often this is something that, you know, where a national discussion is taking place on a college campuses. But in this case, it's, you know, boarding school campuses, sort of a prurient aspect of kind of pulling back the curtain on, you know, life at an elite school. But, you know, it touches on our sort of hookup culture. It touches on the way young people interact electronically as well. You know, there's a lot to this as well as, you know, something with big implications for both these young people. And it'll be interesting how this pans out, not simply in terms of whether or not the defendant, Owen LaBrie, is found guilty of the several charges he faces, which include, you know, forcible rape, statutory rape, and some other charges around the use of electronic communications. But what this means for St. Paul's School, I've been in the courtroom, and one thing that's interesting is former Attorney General Michael Delaney is there taking copious notes. He's, you know, been hired by St. Paul's School. You know, there could be a civil suit out of this in and around the culture there and the so-called senior salute, which, you know, it's been described various ways in the media, but it did seem to be sort of an underground or certainly unofficial springtime rite where outgoing seniors would, you know, more or less proposition younger students for, you know, romantic and or sexual interludes that could be, as, you know, as described in the court, as benign as a kiss on the cheek to, you know, whatever you could imagine. And, you know, what did the school know about this? And, you know, how easy might this sort of conduct be to police in this day and age? And, you know, so there's a lot going on in this case.
So that's part of the issue, too, then, Josh, not just the particular trial against this young man, but also the school in general, that they should have been more aware of this.
Well, I mean, both sides have brought up the senior salute as, you know, it certainly was this is how this encounter began. You know, we haven't the defendant who is purportedly going to testify hasn't taken the stand yet. One thing that's been interesting is the depth of the electronic record, because there were a lot of emails between the accuser and the alleged perpetrator and their Facebook messages. And, you know, and so far one other student who wasn't directly involved has testified. It'll be interesting to see what sort of electronic record can be introduced for the prosecution getting it, you know, emails, Facebook posts, other things that the defendant may have said that would shed light on his motives or general MO on campus. So this case is going to extend at least through the middle of next week.
Okay. Well, and as you said, Josh, we heard from the alleged victim this week. We'll hear from Owen LaBrie next week. Here's a little bit of the girl in the rape trial that we've been talking about, telling the jury that after failed efforts to stop the older male student from having sex with her, she just froze, basically.
I feel like I objected as much as I felt I could at the time. And other than that, I felt so powerless and weak that I couldn't do anything else.
And here's an email from Marge also on this. She says, the responses on the St. Paul's case is so upsetting, Marge says. One, the victim is not, quote, an accuser. Some of the headlines have identified her as that. Marge says, at the very least, she is an alleged rape victim. Two, Marge says, description of her cross-examination is heart-wrenching. She is blamed for her words, her texts, for smiling and laughing. No means no, Marge says, even if the person is laughing or smiling, even if the person texts you afterwards. Marge, thank you very much for that email. And again, NHPR will be covering this story along with many other news outlets. Gentlemen, I did want to turn to another story that we covered on The Exchange. Jeff Feingold, to turn to you first. This week, Eversource Energy revealed its Forward New Hampshire plan. Now, we devoted a whole hour to this yesterday, but just review for us, please, Jeff, for those who didn't catch the show. How big a change is this from what Northern Pass had been presenting to the state?
It's a pretty substantial change. They previously had agreed to or offered to bury about 8 miles of the line way up north, but now they're going to bury another 52 miles of the line, which would be a total of 60. The line would be a little bit longer, so it'll be less than a third of the Northern Pass transmission line will be buried, though, which is one of the key arguments or demands of people who've opposed it. Also, another thing that they've done to kind of sweeten the pot was to set up some kind of $200 million economic development fund, which I don't know what the details are of that, but, you know, it sounds like that's a good chunk of change. It's more than the state pays, offers, you know, in economic development. There's also one of the other key things is that, which is another argument of people who've opposed who've criticized Northern Pass, that they would guarantee 10% of the power transmitted would go to New Hampshire customers, because that was one of the major arguments was,
right,
we're going to have this thing go through New Hampshire, we're not going to get any of the power. So they're going to say, we're going to have 10% of the power will go to New Hampshire, to Eversource customers in New Hampshire. And, you know, the other thing is that part of the proposal of the route would now go through state rights of way. Now, that's an interesting thing, because the state would, because of that, get a piece of the action on this. On this project,
so a source of cash for the state. Vermont has something similar,
absolutely,
planned.
And that was another argument that people who had been posing it said, "Well, why doesn't if you do it along the state right away, the state can get some of this money?" So they've obviously thought this very through very carefully, and they've come up with this plan that has apparently gotten some people to soften their opposition, or at least to say, well, you know, we're interested in hearing more about this. There's still some opponents, obviously, up in the north, way up north, where it's not going to be buried at all. But the governor seemed to be a little bit more interested in it, and I know that Senate President Morse has already endorsed this, saying this is it's a great idea.
Well, again, we talked about this yesterday in the exchange, but here's Bill Quinlan, president of Eversource New Hampshire Operations, talking about this week's new Northern Pass proposal.
We've listened to New Hampshire. That's why we selected the White Mountain National Forest, the Franconia Notch area, the Appalachian Trail, and addressed that by going underground in those regions. And then really it comes down to the question of, you know, is it an affordable project? We think we've struck the right balance among those three critical variables.
Again, that's Bill Quinlan with Eversource talking about the Northern Pass this week on The Exchange. You can join us. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. A couple Facebook comments from our listeners on Northern Pass. John says Northern Pass should rethink the cost of burying the whole system or scrapping the plan altogether. Another different John says not good enough. So there's some Facebook comments on that story. Gary Reno, real quick to you. The White House this week promised to allocate more money to eastern states struggling with a heroin and opioid addiction crisis, including New Hampshire. How much money will New Hampshire get?
New Hampshire will get about $260,000.
Of the total?
Of the total $5 million. That money is basically going to be used to link up law enforcement with the healthcare communities so that they can better target prevention rather than punishment is the idea, prevention and treatment rather than punishment.
So sounds like some amount of money going
toward
this.
Some amount of money. I mean, it's not a lot of money, but it's some amount of money, and any amount of money is good at this point as far as most people are concerned, because we've had such an issue with developing treatment in the state, because we don't have the infrastructure right now, and anything that can help do that is certainly a positive, most people see.
All right. Well, and there was another news item on where another new teen treatment center might be put. I'll ask you guys about that after a short break, and we will update the presidential primary here in the Granite State. Lots of Republican contenders around New Hampshire this week. All that plus your questions and comments. Stay with us for more Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Gary Reno, Jeff Feingold, and Josh Rogers. Join us as we cover some of the top stories of the week around the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, in a moment, I do want to ask you about all the candidates that were in New Hampshire this week. And boy, there was a lot of them. But Gary Reno, just to finish up on our conversation before the break about trying to find more money for drug treatment here in the Granite State, trying to find more places that can do drug treatment here in the Granite State. This week, the Sununu Center in Manchester talked about taking on a bigger role in this area. Just to remind us, Gary, what the Sununu Center is.
Sununu Center is the state's basically youth detention center, is what it used to be called. Now it's the Sununu Youth Services Center. But it's where you put the kids who really don't belong in a home or a school setting to sort of cool their jets for a little while.
Have they committed crimes?
They committed crimes or they're a risk to themselves or others or things like that. When they're there, they get drug treatment. They get mental health treatment. They try to rehabilitate these kids best they can. Part of the problem is the cost of that rehabilitation is about twice what it is in the private sector. So the House and the Senate both wanted to cut significantly the Sununu Center's funding.
Maybe even close it.
Even close it was the House basically wanted to do. The Senate says, well, we'll give it a year. And so, and Governor Hassan wants to keep it open. So they had a meeting down there, and essentially it's about a third of capacity. It was built with federal money 10 years ago, and it's to hold about 150 kids. It holds about 50 kids now. And so part of the suggestion is, well, maybe we could use this for a treatment center for young adults or young people mental health problems and addiction problems. And people seem to be kind of excited about this opportunity.
Well, you've got the space, why not?
And you have these programs already in place. It's just a matter of expanding them.
Well, here's Penny Sampson. She's director of the Sununu Youth Center in Manchester, saying while it's a good thing that the number of juveniles living there is down, the facility is on board with expanding services. Let's hear from her.
The numbers are down nationally for juvenile detention facilities because we're doing a better job diagnosing kids earlier on. And so for us to look at serving a wider array of needs of substance use issues and mental health issues, I think this is a great conversation.
All right. And again, we'll see what happens with that story. Did you want to follow up at all, Gary, on that?
No, I think we'll see some movement here in the final budget resolution one way or the other on this one.
All right. Well, turning to presidential candidates, and boy, there were plenty to track. Josh Rogers, who were you and the rest of the news department following this week?
Donald Trump, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, John Kasich, Carly Fiorina. Others were here. I think those are the ones that we could get people out to cover. You know, there was an education summit that took place at Londonderry High School where it was sponsored by an organization interested in school choice, and a lot of the talk was about, you know, reducing the reach of government. And, you know, there was a lot of agreement. There was some, you know, again, the Common Core education standards is an issue that divides some Republicans. Jeb Bush has been a defender. John Kasich has been a supporter of them as well. You know, so has Bobby Jindal, who is now vehemently opposed to them. So that was going on. I mean, there was an interesting kind of dueling town hall meetings of Donald Trump and Jeb Bush. And, you know, one thing that's been interesting is that, you know, at this point, the way in which, you know, Donald Trump, a lot of candidates were, you know, sort of keeping at arm's length, didn't really want to get into it with him, figured, you know, he would sink on his own accord. That has not happened by any means thus far. He's now the front runner most everywhere. And you're seeing candidates try to engage him in different ways. Jeb Bush, who largely tried not to talk about Donald Trump, is really going after him. You have Scott Walker, who is probably losing, you know, it figured some of the people who are supporting Trump would have been supporting him, saying that, you know, he's going to toughen his talk in order to appeal to Trump voters without you know, going after Trump per se, and Trump's introduction of a very specific immigration proposal has, you know, it's sort of, you know, made everyone have to respond to it. I mean, he already had that. That's the issue. He allegedly sort of rode to the top of the polls. And now you have Republicans earlier on. It was, you know, the default position of most Republicans, even those who have been supportive of immigration reform, such as Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush. They have all said for some time, well, the first thing we need to do is we need to fix the border. Then we might be able to have a discussion down the road. And now, you know, you've got all these people discussing so-called anchor babies, which, you know, might be fine in a Republican primary. That may not mean good things for Republicans come the general election.
Anchor babies are, I mean, I know what it is, Josh, but just what's an anchor baby?
Birthright citizenship, the idea that a child born here, you know, under the Constitution, to parents who are illegally are United States citizens. That's something that Donald Trump would like to get rid of and is something that other Republicans are having to wrestle with.
Yeah, and Josh brought up a really good point about this, because what's happened is that the longer Trump remains at the top, and he really is basically taking a lot of the oxygen out of everything. We're talking about him right now. And he's really driving the whole discussion on, especially on issues like immigration, can be really difficult for the Republicans once whoever the nominee is in the general election, because if you look at the demographics, it's just not working. It won't work for them unless there's some huge shift in the political landscape. And the other thing I have to say is I was listening to Trump being interviewed on the radio the other day, and he was trying. He came up with a new argument on differentiating himself from the other candidates. And he called the other candidates low energy candidates. And it's interesting because if you see someone like Scott Walker, who had electrified the crowd at this CPAC thing of several months ago, and people say, oh, look at all the energy he has. He's not a high energy candidate. Even he's admitting he needs to put more energy in his campaign.
Or you have Jeb Bush, who said, you know, I'm going to be the tortoise in this race, meaning slow and steady. You know, Trump has branded him low energy, and you know, we'll see where this goes. I mean, again, it's traditionally, you know, this is August. once people are back in school, allegedly the electorate becomes more serious about, you know, vetting candidates, and that's the rule of thumb in a year when the elections are in November. It also tends to be how it goes in the New Hampshire primary. But you know, this is, I mean, it would be foolish to suggest that Donald Trump's current position doesn't pretty much defy everybody's expectations, except perhaps his own.
But the point that I'm trying to make is that with such a large field of candidates and with Donald Trump getting so much of the attention, it's really difficult for some of those backbench, lower tier candidates to get any kind of traction. It's going to be I wouldn't be surprised if some of them just kind of say, just, you know, give up after pretty shortly.
Gary?
What's kind of interesting is some of the candidates that were very much in the forefront 6 months ago, like Chris Christie, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Senator Rand Paul.
Scott Walker.
I mean, they're now down in the pack. They're really sort of slipping in the polls. And you wonder how much longer somebody like Chris Christie can really hang in there.
Well, it's tough given that there are so many candidates. It's hard to get attention anyway. Yeah. And then you do have a figure like Donald Trump who just naturally seems to gather so much attention. Since one of you mentioned Scott Walker, you're right. There was a lot of hope when he jumped in that he would be sort of the energetic grassroots fighter. Here is the governor of Wisconsin, and again, GOP presidential candidate Scott Walker, in New Hampshire this week, describing his alternative to the Affordable Care Act. This is how he describes his health plan. He would repeal the ACA and replace it with this plan that he described at an event in Barrington on Wednesday.
It gives you a tax credit to go out and be able to purchase it on your own where you'd like. Changes things so you can buy it across state lines. You're not restricted to one area. It ensures that if you have a pre-existing condition or you get sick, that you can't be knocked off of coverage or you can't be bumped up in terms of the cost.
So there's Scott Walker talking about what he would replace the Affordable Care Act with. And, you know, guys, a lot of people said that the Affordable Care Act would be a big deal in this election, but it seems, Jeff Feingold, to be more about immigration now.
Yeah, it is. It's another example of the Trump phenomenon. He's really driving the conversation, and Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, just seems to be just not disappearing as an issue, but just not the red meat people thought it was going to be.
Well, and you know, you look at somebody like Trump, and you know, in a lot of ways, and you know, he's been supportive of Democrats in the past. I mean, he has at times come out in favor of single payer health care, and he's
really
yes. And mm-hmm. And one thing that's interesting about him is that, you know, you have Republicans who you know, talk about reforming our entitlement programs. You know, he says, you know, he chided Mitt Romney when he picked Paul Ryan is his running mate, you know, for that reason. He's the guy that's going to cut entitlement programs. And, you know, Trump says, you know, we're going to make the country so rich we don't need to cut entitlements. And, you know, the mix of policy statements and the crowds he draws, it's really strange. I mean, there are doctrinaire conservatives. You go to an event, there are, you know, people in the New Hampshire House, very, very arch conservatives who are there. And you know, it doesn't seem to make much difference if you say, well, you know, Donald Trump has said this, that, and the other through the years.
Sort of more liberal takes on Medicare and Medicaid.
And they're just like, well, he's saying it like it is now.
Yeah, well, he's actually even said that Bill Clinton was his favorite president. I mean, you know, and it's not really – these people are still showing up for him at his events. And it's really – it is a phenomenon. It's something I can't remember anything like this happening before.
Gary?
Well, I mean, it's just I don't know. You can look at it a lot of ways. But, I mean, you look back 4 years ago when he was running around New Hampshire and nobody was paying any attention to him. And now all of a sudden the ground has shifted, you know, and everybody thinks he's the one who's going to be the savior.
I want to ask you guys about Democrats in a minute. But here's an email from Ray in Whitefield. He says, of all the Republican candidates, I thought Mr. Kasich, that's the Ohio governor, was the most credible. However, his recent wishy-washy comment about climate change and the comment that teacher lounges should be eliminated is proof that he's just another typical duplicitous politician, Ray says. Ray says, also, when Mr. Christie, Ms. Fiorina et al. Spend a week in a second-grade classroom in Manchester or another town accomplishing and performing all the functions of a teacher, then I will listen to their criticisms on teachers. Josh Rogers, this goes back to the education forum that you talked about earlier. A lot of these candidates, in fact, all of them at the event, had some pretty harsh stuff to say about teachers' unions. And then they took pains to say, no, 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 we love teachers, but we don't like those naughty unions.
Well, that's not surprising at a GOP event. you know, teachers' unions are, you know, not everyone goes so far as what, you know, Governor Christie said, which is we'd like to punch them in the face. And, you know, Kasich's remark about the teachers' lounge, like, you know, that you know, a lot of that could be interpreted as a joke, but obviously, you know, this is a pretty partisan thing. I mean, the education unions, they vote Democrat. Republicans favor school choice. They favor tenure reform. They favor things that teachers' unions don't like. There are philosophical differences. I mean, a lot of the Republicans would say that, you know, point to their records on education. That's something that, you know, Jeb Bush likes to talk about a lot, and people can argue about the merits of his claims, but that's certainly something that he tends to focus on the campaign trail. I mean, but this is a deep philosophical divide.
Okay, well, since we've been talking about Ohio Governor John Kasich, again, gaining some ground in some of the early states, here he is in New Hampshire at that education summit, tying his spirituality to his views on education.
I believe the Lord watches what we do with our children. And the more we dedicate ourselves to having those children rise and to use their great brains to help heal this world and bring justice, the happier he is.
Again, that's Ohio Governor and GOP presidential hopeful John Kasich speaking in New Hampshire this week. And all of you, so lots of activity this week on the Republican side. Any Democrats in New Hampshire over this past week?
There will be some coming through, but coming, you know, last week. And, you know, I mean, John Kasich is interesting. He seems to be picking up steam in New Hampshire. I mean, that may be benefited by, you know, $4 million worth of ads that were run. You know, he was the last in the race. The question was, was he going to make it into that first debate? There was a lot of positive advertising run. And, you know, he's also picked up some establishment endorsements. You know, Tom Rath, former attorney general, former RNC member, Doug Scammon, people who, you know, one might have assumed on paper would be more likely to end up gravitating towards Jeb Bush. So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, he Kasich runs as a more moderate Republican, and, you know, people say that given he was governor of Ohio and has managed to get reelected, that could be quite helpful in a general election. Certainly, you know, how well Kasich, you know, plays in other parts of the country, you know, remains to be seen. He seems to be picking up steam here. And, you know, his kind of, you know, it's been described as sort of a Pope Francis sort of Republicanism. You know, he talks about his Catholicism and about, you know, serving the less fortunate and his own blue collar background. His father was a mail carrier. And he's engaging on the stump. I mean, there have been questions about whether, you know, temperamentally he's a bit mercurial and sort of can be prickly at times. You know, he's certainly, you know, one to watch in New Hampshire
Pope
at the moment.
Pope Francis conservatism. Is that what you called it, Josh? Yeah, and that's how he –
that's
how
Republicanism.
Republicanism. Yeah, okay. Well, and I think that's an interesting point because at the big debate, Governor Kasich did – you know, he was pressed on why he agreed to expand Medicaid, Jeff Feingold, and that's sort of, you know, a lot of conservatives say, no, you shouldn't do that because it's part of Obamacare. Yeah, and Governor Kasich said, well, my faith says I need to take care of the poor.
It was really interesting because, you know, he's on the stage with people who absolutely oppose expanding Medicaid and many of them in the field. Actually, some of them as governors have opposed doing it, you know, themselves. But it is interesting to me that John Kasich does seem like the kind of candidate who New Hampshire Republican voters might gravitate to as things shake out. And it's – I think, you know, when you talk about how Donald Trump's affecting Scott Walker, well, I also think Kasich is also affecting Jeb Bush. I mean, I think that that's something that needs to bear watching because a lot of the people supporting John Kasich, you know, you would have said, oh, they're going to vote for Bush in the end, and they're not.
Well, in Kasich you know, when he ran, I mean, he briefly ran in 2000.
And, I remember. You know,
and back then, I mean, he was running as a sort of, you know, compassionate conservative. And then, you know, George W. Bush came in and, you know, he was gone. And so it's interesting. It's interesting.
I see. That's an interesting flip. Okay. Well, all of you, next week, last week of August, Gary Reno, typically you hear the crickets chirping at the State House. But what are you going to be watching?
You know, you do hear the crickets chirping at the State House on the last week of August. But there's going to be an executive council meeting down in Dover on Wednesday. Nothing particularly big, not like the last one with the Planned Parenthood. But the what might be interesting is the Department of Transportation is releasing its draft 10-year highway plan, and there are going to be some significant changes in that.
Since the sinkhole or just?
Well, no, this is it has nothing to do with the sinkhole, but who knows? It may be getting another revision.
Jeff, are you off next week or are you out covering the news?
Well, actually, we're going to be looking at looking more details at the Northern Pass proposal and, okay. and kind of find out you know what this $200 million is about and how you get the 10% of the cuts. But then also next weekend is Traverse Stakes, so that's a big deal too.
Okay.
You personally.
Josh, who are you going to be following around?
Whoever comes through town.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much for being with us. And The Exchange will be taking a break next week. We'll be playing some of our favorites, so stay tuned for that. And thank you all very much for being here. We appreciate it. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer, Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.